Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For more than 20 years, the oil industry has battled for permission to drill for oil in the 1.5 million acre coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in the northeast corner of Alaska. Today, the oil men got their green light. In a narrow 51-49 split, the U.S. Senate effectively cleared the way for oil drilling in the Arctic Refuge. The vote marked a major victory for the Bush administration and its energy policy. It came as a huge blow to environmentalists who have long fought to protect what some have called America's Serengeti, what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has called one of the finest examples of wilderness left on the planet. Environmentalists say they haven't given up, but they've taken a huge hit. Tonight on Point, we'll go to Washington, Alaska, and beyond to measure the impact of opening ANWR and what today's vote says about the direction and future of U.S. energy policy. We go first tonight to Washington, where Justin Blum, energy reporter for The Washington Post, has covered today's action in the Senate. Justin Blum, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us exactly what has happened here. This is part of the huge budget bill, and what was the step that was taken today?
Well, Republicans had included in the budget that's under consideration a provision calling for this portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to be opened. And so what happened today was that Democrats, joined by a few moderate Republicans, tried to strip that provision out of the Senate version of the budget. And the Democrats' effort narrowly failed by the 51-49 vote. So what happens next is the Senate has to finish work on the budget. Presumably, the House will, possibly as early as tomorrow, the budget will have to go to conference, and there is still a possibility that the House and Senate may not agree on the budget because there are other controversial items included in it. But as the budget goes, ANWR goes.
And the vote today indicates that what they don't have in the Senate is a majority willing to step up and save ANWR in particular. The budget, one way or another, is likely to roll ahead with the Republican minority, or majority, I should say.
The budget is likely to roll ahead, but there are very contentious issues that threaten to pit the House and the Senate against each other. And if that happens, that could throw the future of this budget into question, which will decide the fate of ANWR.
But the unique feature this year is including the ANWR question in the budget, which doesn't require more than a simple majority. Therefore, the filibuster threat doesn't apply here, as it has in the past.
That's right. In some previous years, opponents of drilling in ANWR have staged a filibuster, and to stop a filibuster and move on with a vote, you need 60 votes. And so the supporters of ANWR in previous years weren't able to achieve that 60-vote majority. So by inserting it in the budget, you only need a 51-vote majority, and there's no possibility of a filibuster.
Justin, we see oil industry representatives receiving this as pretty much a victory here tonight. How long and how hard have they been pushing for permission to drill, to explore for oil in ANWR?
Well, supporters of drilling in ANWR have been at it for almost two decades, and in more recent years, the oil companies have been rather subdued in their public statements about ANWR. The CEO of Chevron Texaco has told me that he's interested in drilling in the refuge, but other companies have been more reluctant recently to make public statements about it. But the trade association representing the oil industry has been very supportive and says many of its members are interested in drilling.
And it's been central to the Bush administration's energy policy.
It's been a piece of the Bush administration's energy policy, and the administration has been lobbying heavily for it ever since taking office.
What about environmentalists today? How are they handling the setback in the Senate?
Well, they're obviously not pleased, but they're saying that the fight is not yet over and that there are other opportunities for them to try to strip out this provision opening ANWR to drilling.
Will they fight in the courts if they can't win on Capitol Hill? Do they have grounds there?
That's a good question. You'll have to ask them.
We will do that. And what about public opinion, Justin? Where does it stand on the issue of drilling in the Arctic Refuge?
I think it probably depends on who you talk to, which state you measure public opinion in, and how you ask the question. Members of the Senate have cited polling data and other surveys on both sides of the issue to make their point. And so it could probably go either way.
And Justin, I'm sure we'll hear lots of numbers tonight, but what's your best take on how much oil is in the refuge, how much of America's demand for oil it might one day satisfy?
Well, government reports suggest that by 2025, about 1 million barrels a day of oil could be pumped from this portion of the refuge. Of course, these are just estimates. So with the oil from the refuge, the U.S. would, in 2025, import about 65% of its oil, according to government models, versus about 68% foreign oil without the oil from ANWR.
So a 3% difference in what the country imports and the fight taking a huge step today. Justin Blum in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Blum, energy reporter for The Washington Post, speaking with us there from Washington. We are talking tonight about today's green light on Capitol Hill for oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You can join the conversation. Is this a victory for energy security, a tragedy for Arctic ecology? How do you see the opening of ANWR? Are you still ready to fight it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Eagle River, Alaska, that's north of Anchorage, is Ken Boyd. He is former director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the state of Alaska from 1995 to 2001. He's currently an oil and gas consultant. Ken Boyd, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure to be here, Tom.
And joining us from Washington is Mike Dalton, lead lobbyist for the Arctic Refuge and assistant director of government relations at the National Audubon Society. Mike Dalton, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Ken Boyd, how do you interpret this day's action on Capitol Hill? Are you sending up fireworks there?
No, I'm personally pleased with it. It's, you know, I've been here for almost 30 years, and I've been in the oil business for a long time, first as an explorationist and then in government and now as a consultant, but followed it pretty closely. You've done a lot of testimony, and I think it's about time that this has happened. It's something that was mandated by Congress itself when the refuge was formed in 1980 through ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. It said that this 1.5 million acres should be evaluated for its oil and gas potential, and now they've taken a step forward to doing that finally.
Ken, we've seen national polls that show Americans opposed to going in there, but remind us of how Alaskans feel about it.
The polls that have been taken in Alaska, Tom, have mostly run about 75% in favor. But, you know, most importantly is right in the ANWR itself, in on the coastal plain. The only town that's there is the town of Kaktovik. It's an Inupiat Eskimo community that's been there probably for centuries. The people that live there, you know, are, again, about 75% in favor of it. And it's, in Alaska, it's very unusual to have in my backyard say, yes, please go ahead and drill here. That doesn't happen very often anywhere, and it certainly doesn't happen very often in Alaska.
Of course, Alaskans make money when the drilling goes on. What about this estimate that in 2025, if we drill and produce oil in the Arctic Refuge, we'll be importing 65% of our oil instead of 68. Is it worth opening up this wilderness area for that margin difference in imported oil?
Yeah, and again, I don't think it's because of the margin. I think it's because of the barrels of domestic oil that we produce. I mean, Prudhoe Bay, you know, it produced about 20% of the nation's oil, and it's about the same size. Again, the numbers are estimates. There are nobody knows how much oil is in ANWR, but, you know, Prudhoe's produced about 13 billion barrels of oil. The mean that the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, projects is about 10. Another million barrels a day is another million barrels a day. It's the same amount of oil we've imported from Iraq in the past, and I think it does offset and gives us some cushion on having, you know, a secure source of oil for our country.
Ken Boyd, stand by. In Alaska, Mike Dalton in Washington, environmentalists have fought long and hard to keep the wall up around this refuge. Today, a big hole blown in that. How are you feeling about it tonight?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm completely sickened by what happened in the United States Senate today. I think that those that want to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will do or say anything to get their hands on that place, and they proved it today. They were sneaking this thing through on a budget bill that doesn't have fair and open debate. The normal rules of procedure, like the filibuster, were completely off limits, and that's how you're supposed to do controversial policy issues. You're supposed to allow those that are in the minority to use all of the tools at their disposal to make sure that the voice of the American people are heard, and the American people are with us on this issue. And I do want to say that, you know, this was a hit today, but this is just like the first game of a championship series, and the Red Sox showed us, you know, if you lose one game, that doesn't mean you're out of it.
Well, maybe so, but this game's been going on, this series has been going on a long time, and it looks to me like the biggest hit the environmental movement's ever taken around Anwar.
Well, I don't know if I would go that far. I mean, both the House and the Senate have, on their own, approved drilling in the past. There's always been something that has tripped this up before it gets to the president's desk and gets a signature, and I think because the American people are so overwhelmingly opposed, we still remain confident that the U.S. Congress will ultimately listen to them and protect this place.
Ken Boyd, 20 seconds before we have to take a break here, but are you feeling confident tonight that the drills will roll, that there will now be exploration, be drilling in Anwar?
Well, since we're using sports analogies, I'll switch to basketball and say there's no slam dunks, but I think this is a big step forward, and I think we're farther along than we have been any time in the past.
Ken Boyd in Eagle River, Alaska, please stand by. Ken is former director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the state of Alaska, and Mike Dalton with the Audubon Society in Washington. We're talking tonight about today's green light in Washington to drill for oil in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Did you think this day would come, that oil interests would ultimately triumph over environmentalists in Alaska? Join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about today's vote to effectively open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil exploration. You can join us tonight. Is this a victory for energy security, a tragedy for Arctic ecology? How do you see the opening of Anwar? And what does the Senate's Anwar vote say about U.S. priorities? What does it say about U.S. energy policy? What does it say about U.S. environmental policy? Is it worth opening up the Alaskan refuge for perhaps 10 billion barrels of oil? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This morning, President Bush spoke about his hopes for a new energy policy from Congress.
I would hope that when members go back to their districts and hear the complaints of people about the rising price of gasoline or complaints from small business owners about the cost of energy, that they will come back. And in the spirit of in a proper spirit, get a bill to my desk that encourages conservation and continue to find alternative sources of energy.
President Bush speaking this morning about U.S. energy policy. We're joined tonight from Eagle River, Alaska, by Ken Boyd, former director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the state of Alaska, currently an oil and gas consultant, and from Washington by Mike Dalton, lead lobbyist for the Arctic Refuge at the National Audubon Society. Ken Boyd, I wish you'd describe for us exactly what portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge would be opened for oil exploration.
Okay. Well, you know, Anwar was created in 1980. It's about 19.5 million acres. It's in the extreme northeast corner of Alaska. If you can picture Alaska, it's in the northeast corner. It's right on the Canadian border. Of the 19.5 million acres, 18 million acres are already in wilderness or refuge status, and the debate today and always has been about the 1.5 million acres, the so-called coastal plain, mm-hmm. or the 1002 area, that is right on the Arctic Ocean. If you walk north through the coastal plain, you'd walk right into the Arctic Ocean. So it's you can't see the end. You can just about see the end of the world from there. It's a very remote place.
Ken Boyd, I years ago, as a very young man, worked at Prudhoe Bay and actually worked right up next to the Arctic Refuge at Bullen Point, if you know that area.
Yes, I do.
So I know what it looks like. I know what's happened at Prudhoe Bay, and I've seen how pristine it was east of there, near the Canadian border that you describe. Gail Norton, the Interior Secretary, is writing this week that the technology of exploration has advanced so far that it need barely leave an imprint on this coastal plain. What do you say about that? Is it possible to do this exploration without damage to the environment?
Well, you know, I can't say it will be, you know, if you do development, if you actually get to production, there's going to be some disruption. I mean, there's going to be some gravel on the ground. There's going to be people, there's going to be people working. But in the exploration phase itself, I think that's a true statement, that there will be no damage because all exploration in Alaska is done in the winter. And I don't know how long ago you were there, Tom, but, I mean, the technology has changed so dramatically now that there'll be no more Prudhoe Bays. There'll be no more dead horses. I mean, it's going to be dead horses, a town within Prudhoe Bay.
And by that, you mean the kind of industrial sprawl that is now Prudhoe Bay and Dead Horse.
Right, exactly.
But exploration is just step one. I mean, if you do that, step two is drill it.
Even phase one can include drilling. It'll first be, you know, the seismic or the sound waves going into the ground. Then there'll be drilling. But, again, in the exploration phase, that's all done in the winter.
But, I mean, that is just step A. What follows is drilling to pump with everything that suggests, pipelines, machinery.
That exactly right. I mean, that assumes, if you assume then that you make a commercial discovery, then there will be development. There'll be a gravel pad. There'll be a rig there, and there will be a pipeline of some form or fashion that will, you know, head back to the Trans-Alaska pipeline, 100 miles to the west.
Mike Dalton, it is staggering territory. I've seen those rivers of caribou flow across it. It's just it is like nothing else in the world. At the Audubon Society and in the environmental world, what's your view of Gail Norton's assertion that this can all be done with such a minimal imprint that it's not really an ecological issue?
Oh, well, I think if you just, it's prima facie false. I think if you look over at Prudhoe Bay, you've got 1,000 square miles of industrial sprawl there, that you've got on order of 400 oil spills a year there. You've got really a whole range of road development and pipelines that are carving up that habitat. And these kinds of huge herds of caribou and large mammals like polar bears, they really need much larger expanses of habitat than if you're carving it up with roads and pipelines.
But what we're reading about is it'll just be, I forget the exact number, but a matter of acres where there'll actually be a footprint of the work that's done.
Right, that's absolutely false. I mean, this is the way that they've decided to spin it. They said it's only 2,000 acres of development. The problem with that, of course, is that it's not contiguous. They could put that 2,000 acres anywhere in the refuge. They're going to lease all 1.5 million acres. And, you know, to call it a footprint is sort of like saying that the size of a spider web can be described by the width of the strands of web. And it's just not the case. The geological reach of that development is going to be much larger than 2,000 acres.
So on the other side of whatever it turns out to be, 10 or 20 or 30 years of development, what do you anticipate this pristine wilderness would look like in ecological terms, Mike?
I think it's going to be a real travesty, really. I mean, if you think about it, there's no such thing as a wilderness oil field. And what they're doing is going into a place that is absolutely pristine right now. If you're a wildlife biologist, you'd aspire to create places that are operating as naturally as the Arctic Refuge is. And they're going to go in there and put in industrial oil development and oil spills, and it's going to have a real impact.
Ken Boyd, do you see it differently?
Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, this notion of pristine wilderness is a favorite expression, but tell that to the people that live there. I mean, people are saying if you put a single footprint here, then it's no longer a wilderness. Well, then, by definition, this is not a wilderness because you have 700 Inupiat Eskimos that live there, drive snow machines there.
But that village you're talking about, Kaktovik, I mean, that's minute compared to what we're talking about with this oil development effort.
Agree. But people drive snow machines throughout the refuge, I mean, to go hunting.
Yeah, but that's 700 people in such a... I mean, we take your point there, but on the other... Never mind the Inuits or the current residents. After this development, what do you think the ecological status of that region will be?
I mean, I can only compare it to things that I've seen elsewhere on the slope. This is another piece of the North Slope. And the modern oil fields like Alpine, that is 100 acres to develop, you know, 40,000 acres of subsurface. the footprints are very small. Is there some impact? Yes. Yes, there is. But you're talking about a million barrels of oil, of domestic oil a day. So, yes, there's going to be something there, but it's going to be, I think, very minimal. I don't know where it's going to be because I don't know where the oil is or even if there is any oil there.
You've done, you've helped on the exploration, and I've seen your writing saying there's a pretty good chance.
Well, I mean, I don't know much more than the USGS knows in terms of that. I mean, they've made their estimates, and the only way to find oil is with a drill bit. I mean, there's very little data there. There's going to have to be a couple of seasons, I believe, of seismic data before companies are going to be willing to even bid or drill. So we still have a couple of years of public process to go through before we ever get there.
But as we talk tonight, the drill bit is, it would appear, where we're most likely headed. Ken Boyd, thank you very much for being with us from Eagle River, Alaska tonight.
It was my pleasure, Tom.
Ken Boyd, former director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the state of Alaska. I want to turn now to Robert Kaufman. He's joining us from Newton, Massachusetts. He's a professor at the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. Robert Kaufman, thank you for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
How do you interpret the Senate's action today, the green light given for oil exploration? What does this say about American energy policy and its priorities?
Well, to me, it just says, you know, I think one senator put it best. People are looking around, they're seeing that gasoline prices are high, and something has to be done. And this is what the Senate came up with, drilling the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. In terms of policy, that's not going to really fix anything now or in the future, but it appears as though we're doing something.
It's presented as an energy security issue, as a step toward energy security. President Bush has characterized it that way. Is that a fair statement? I think a lot of laymen have difficulty getting their minds around exactly how much oil there, how important it is to U.S. energy security overall.
We have to think very carefully about this term, energy security. What people need to realize is the world oil market is really one big pool of oil, and it really doesn't matter whether you get your oil from Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, or the North Slope of Alaska. Whatever the world price is, that's the price you're going to pay. And if ever there's a disruption somewhere in the world, that disruption travels through the world oil market, because the people who used to, you know, if you get less oil, if the Saudis don't sell oil, the people who used to buy oil from the Saudis, they're going to go to the people like the Venezuelans who supply the U.S. with oil. So it's really a myth to believe that if you produce more domestically or somehow you wean yourself away from the Middle East, that you've somehow created some energy security for yourself.
But we've got senators today saying that there's already evidence. We've got boots on the ground in Iraq, American soldiers' lives at risk in part because there's so much oil there. This is on American soil, and that's the advantage.
What's the advantage in that, as I said, if Saudi Arabia suddenly stops selling you oil, it's not going to make a difference to your supply.
So
it's one world market.
One world market, which with a little piece added in northeastern Alaska.
Maybe, yes.
Maybe. Robert Kaufman, Mike Dalton, stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Jeremy's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
A little piece. Hi.
Hi, Jeremy. Turn your radio down, my friend.
Oh, I just turned it off.
Great.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just want to tell you where I'm coming from. I'm a business owner, and we run a lot of trucks, all diesel. I'm very dependent on the fuel, but what I'm dismayed at, I'm caught off guard because I heard this on the way home. I didn't think it would happen this quick about Anwar.
Yeah.
Why haven't our lawmakers, you know, they want to do something, they did something today, but I also think we got to work on the consumption side, and we're a very economics-driven society, and sometimes we need government to drive our economics, you know, maybe tax SUVs or more research towards fuel efficiency.
So we've seen record highs for crude oil prices just in the last couple of days. Again, Jeremy, your fleet of cars and trucks depends on that kind of oil. What are you suggesting you'd like to see?
Well, I mean, I read a lot about biodiesels, and there's different ways to tax, maybe businesses versus personal. I see a lot of large SUVs, and right now it's not economically feasible. Well, people with money don't mind buying a big car, especially with the recent tax advantages.
But one of the costs may be going right across this border into the wildlife refuge. Jeremy, thanks for that call. Mike Dalton, How about it? When you see the effort that's going to be poured in, if this goes ahead, as it looks like it very well may now, going to be poured into exploring and drilling in Anwar, if that were instead put into developing alternative energy sources, would we have a better payoff?
Absolutely, and I think that what you've heard really from all the panelists, all the experts that you have on the phone today, is that drilling the Arctic Refuge is absolutely no solution to our energy problems, and it's not worth damaging a wildlife refuge that's pristine like this for what really is a very minor drop in the bucket on the world oil market that's going to have no effect on prices and isn't going to make us any more secure from foreign sources of oil.
Robert Kaufman, same question to you. If American resources were put into alternate fuel sources or conservation efforts instead of developing the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, instead of drilling there, is there a possibility of coming up with equivalent energy?
We'd probably do a lot better, and indeed there's actually a historical example. For those of us old enough to remember the first oil shock, we had everybody drilling oil throughout the United States, and what happened was the oil industry doubled its use of investment capital, but it didn't contribute any more to GDP than it did before. So in effect, that industry flushed a large amount of investment capital down the drain without any real payback. And it's very clear that if we directed those same funds to alternatives or conservation that we did in the 80s, we'd be a lot better off now than we are.
So you follow the politics and the policy here. Why do you think the Bush administration has pushed so hard for drilling in Anwar if comparable resources might have a better energy payoff elsewhere? Why?
Well, you know, to me, I think a lot of this argument about Anwar is really, at least the people trying to argue for it, is off point. What really is going on is the Trans-Alaskan pipeline system. Whatever oil comes out of Anwar will go through that pipeline. And that pipeline was originally built to last a certain number of years. And if the owners of that pipeline can really extend its lifetime, those are the people who will do well by this investment.
So
that's why the people of Alaska are so happy about it.
So you're talking about a lot of money being made over existing infrastructure that's currently being underused as the Prudhoe Bay oil fields peter out.
Exactly.
Vincent's calling from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Vincent. You're on the air.
Hi, I was just calling because 20 years ago I worked in an oil exploration crew up there, and so I've watched it February, you know, at 65 below zero when you got about 40 heavy equipment vehicles, many of them with twin engines, burning all the trash in this crew and burning all the diesel fumes, the diesel fuel that goes along with it. And so I just didn't know how many of those senators had an idea what oil exploration actually looks like up there in the middle of the winter, and it really wreaks havoc on the place with all this heavy tracked equipment and dragging 50 guys around and behind D8 bulldozers and in what they call cat trains.
So when it moves over the line into Anwar, do you buy the argument, Vincent, that it won't leave much of a footprint behind?
Oh, no. You can see the footprints from every year if you go up there and take a look at it. They're lasting reminders of the, you know, the oil men coming up there and taking what they need. And granted, there are better protections now, but even 20 years ago, you got trucks that blow up all the time, leaving diesel and hydraulic fluid and a lasting trail of debris.
You made money up there. Lots of Alaskans and others have. How do you feel now as an American citizen about this policy? Do you support it, or would you rather see something different? What?
I'd very much like to see something different. I'm totally against the policy of opening it up. It is one of the most spectacular places. I've been in there in the summer and as well in the winter. And, you know, if you could knock some of the those super low mileage SUV monsters off the road and do a little more on conservation, then you could probably, you know, save some of the more pristine areas like that Anwar is, and it is the essence of pristine up there.
We've got it. Boot the Hummers, save Anwar. Vincent, thanks very much for your call. Mike Dalton, describe for us exactly maybe an example of what's at risk ecologically. The caribou herd, for one thing, can it continue to calve and migrate as it has for, what, I read, 2 million years there?
Well, I think that if you talk to the expert biologists in Alaska, that they'll tell you that there is going to be a significant impact. The National Academy of Sciences did an exhaustive review of the caribou issues last year, and they concluded that there would be significant impacts to the caribou herd. What happens is that the studies have found that caribou avoid the oil infrastructure by an average of about 2.5 miles. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that the caribou get displaced from their primary habitat. And that can have a real impact because they're getting away from their primary feeding sources, and they're getting driven into areas where there's increased predation and insect harassment, which is a major problem for them because they will not have the kind of fat reserves they need to have some successful birthing of their calves.
And on the bird front, it's a major migration spot there. What's the impact? You're with the Audubon Society.
Yeah, it's a major problem. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, if you saw the Exxon Valdez spill, you'll remember that they were pulling a lot of oil-covered birds out of that oil, and it's a major problem. That oil is toxic to birds. It destroys the insulating capacity of feathers.
Of course, the idea is not to have an Exxon Valdez-style spill.
Well, that's still a real possibility on the north slope of Alaska around Prudhoe Bay. The National Academy of Sciences concluded that's still a real risk for the oil operations out there. And oil spills will be a problem if they bring the oil rigs up into the coastal plain.
We've got to take a short break. Mike Dalton, Robert Kaufman, please stand by. What do you think, listeners? How much faith do you put in assurances that the environmental impact of drilling in Anwar will be minimal? And is the country irresponsibly throwing away a pristine wilderness for a few months' supply of oil? Or is this energy realism at work in an era of dwindling oil supplies? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's green light in Washington to drill for oil in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Anwar. You can join the conversation tonight. If Washington can't find a better path to energy than breaking open Anwar, is any American refuge safe from development? And would all the effort spent on opening Anwar be better spent on alternative energy supplies, like what? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Washington, Mike Dalton, is with us. He's lead lobbyist for the Arctic Refuge for the National Audubon Society. And Robert Kaufman joins us tonight from the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. Right now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Gary is on the line. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things I heard earlier, and I had already noticed it as well, is nobody has talked about what happens to the Alaskan pipeline and what happens to Anwar. And when I was studying this a couple years ago, it all of a sudden became obvious to me why the argument was there, because the Alaskan pipeline is scheduled to be shut down in the year 2017. And if Anwar has enough oil, they can extend it another 17 years in life, and then it's done. But
17 years makes a lot of money. Is that the point?
Well, it makes a lot of money, but it also does is make sure that SUVs keep running down the highway. So, as somebody concerned about the environment, it's kind of what I do every single day. One of the things that if we got to make these trade-offs in terms of what we do with the energy, we're going to need energy to jump into alternative energy sources. Solar panels don't, for example, suddenly appear because you expose them to sunlight, or wind turbines don't suddenly appear just because you put all the stuff together on the ground and say, assemble. You got to have the energy.
So how does that relate to developing Anwar, to drilling in Anwar, Gary?
Well, if we're going to use that energy, that oil come out, if that's the choice we're going to make sure that every single drop, every single BTU, every single calorie goes to alternative energy sources and not fueling SUVs.
Gary, we've got it. Robert Kaufman, I wonder on that front. It raises this issue of what the direction that we see strongly laid out today says about how the United States will deal with the last decades of oil. How do you interpret this as an omen of where we're headed?
It doesn't, it's not a very promising omen, because studies really indicate that if you invest now, it makes the transition, and ultimately the transition will have to come, it makes that transition just that much easier.
And you mean invest in alternatives?
Invest in alternatives, whatever it be. Just think about what it will take to replace every gas station in the United States. Let's say we decide that hydrogen is the way to go, or natural gas. You've got to replace every gas station in the United States.
That's a pretty amazing idea.
You have to retrain every auto mechanic. That's something that doesn't happen quickly, that requires a large upfront investment, and as the caller said, that's kind of, you know, you think about what should I do with my last so many million barrels of oil? And really what we should be doing is figuring out how to invest it so that I can get beyond oil.
And let me ask you, just to clarify, this number is bandied about that the Anwar coastal plain drilling might produce enough oil to satisfy U.S. consumption for 6 months. Is that reasonable? That sort of, I don't know if that's 10 billion barrels or whatever it is that a reasonable characterization or not?
Well, it's really a misleading way to look at it, whether you think that's a large number or a small number, in that, as with every oil field, it'll ramp up slowly, peak for a while, and then ramp down. And as the caller correctly identified, and as I argued previously, mm-hmm. that's going to come through the Alaskan pipeline, the TAP system, which at its maximum can transport 2 million barrels per day. So at its best, that pipeline or that field could perhaps supply 5% at current rates of consumption. The U.S. uses about 20 million barrels of oil a day.
And it could provide maybe 5% for how long?
Maybe a couple of years.
5% for a couple of years?
Yeah. Maybe five. I don't know. But, you know.
But that's the exchange here, the wilderness wall for 5% for a couple of years.
Well, one of the things that I would urge the representative from Audubon to do is, if this goes through, force Gail Norton and the industry to put their money where their mouth is. Make them post an assurance bond that says, if anything happens, this money is forfeit by the industry. And if industry knows ahead of time what these accidents and normal operating accidents that you don't hear about in the news but happen every day, I have a feeling the industry will be a lot less anxious to drill there than if they know, well, we can get away with these small accidents, and if something happens 10 or 20 years from now, maybe somebody will take us to court.
You're saying call Gail Norton on her assurances that there will be negligible
right.
environmental impact and have them set up a kind of, what, multi-million, billion-dollar escrow account to
That's
pay
right.
for damage if it occurs?
That's right.
But realistically, Mike Dalton, number one, what do you think about that idea? Have you proposed it? And number two, when there is damage on the tundra, can money fix it?
Well, I think it's an interesting idea, but I would be shocked if Gail Norton or the oil industry would be open to that kind of proposal. I think that the important thing here is we're not willing to concede that these oil drills are headed up to the refuge. We think that some places in the country need to be off limits to oil drilling, and the Arctic Refuge is definitely one of those places.
You may not be willing to concede it, but the Senate took a vote today, and you didn't win it.
Well, that's true. That is true, but I mean, this is a budget process that this was the first stage of a budget process that's not over yet.
But my argument is, if they're not willing to put their money where their mouth is, then why should we believe all their arguments about no impacts? In other words, if there are no impacts, they're not going to lose that money.
Right,
well,
so put it in escrow.
I certainly agree with that point. I think that what you've seen is a lot of promises about based on one test site they call Alpine over sort of on the outskirts of Prudhoe Bay, and that these new drilling technologies that they're talking about, they're not willing to have those technologies be required as part of going into the refuge. And I think what you're going to see there is actually going to be a lot messier and a lot dirtier than what they might have us believe.
Mike Dalton, right? I wish you'd get very specific on how you think you might still stop this. I mean, I have to say tonight it feels kind of like a steamroller. The Republicans appear to have the votes. The House, I assume, is not going to get in the way of this. There's a big demand to get a budget passed. The Democrats can't take it to a filibuster now. Don't have the votes to stop it. So where's the leverage point if you're still trying to stop this?
Well, I think first of all, we think that a lot of members of Congress failed their constituents today, and we hope that the American people who really are opposed to drilling the Arctic Refuge will be letting them know about that today and through in the coming weeks. Secondly, I think that the budget has a lot of extremely controversial items in it. This is not a done deal that this budget resolution is going to pass, and I think the fact that they've now loaded it down with another highly controversial item in the Arctic drilling is going to be another impediment to them to final passage of that budget resolution.
But there will be a budget, and today we didn't see the willingness to pull this piece out. Seamus is calling from West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Seamus. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing, Tom?
Good,
thanks
good
for
thanks.
Having me
sure.
on.
I'll tell you, the thing that really bothers me about today's decision is the fact that it represents the narrow-mindedness of the Bush administration's approach to energy. You know, if they showed a little bit more broad-mindedness, and at the same time they introduced a bill to open up ANWR, they also introduced conservation measures, for instance, tax cuts for hybrid vehicles or additional taxes on SUVs, what they did today would be more palatable. But what we see is just a consistent policy to simply solve energy problems by increased drilling. And I would, as I said, as somebody who is very concerned about the environment, yeah, I'd be acceptable to what they're trying to do if they kind of had a yin and yang approach, which mm-hmm. said, okay, we're going to try to open up the ANWR, but at the same time, we're also going to impose some strict conservation measures. And so it's really bothersome to see this single-minded approach.
Seeing no yang on the other side of that. Seamus,
absolutely,
we've got it, and thanks for your call. Robert Kaufman, I want to ask you, if ANWR is opened up to drilling, is that going to be, in your view, precedent-setting? Are there other American lands currently off-limits that will suddenly look like, you know, good pickings for the oil industry because, hey, if they could do it here, where can't they do it?
You know, my impression, at least on the oil side, is there's no really big fields left anywhere in the continental U.S. or anywhere in the 50 states.
Including that, offshore? We've heard Florida worrying about offshore shelf drilling.
You know, there you've got a very different situation with Florida in that you've got a huge constituency that worries about any kind of accident. My brother lives there. He's a big sports fisherman, the tourism industry. So there within the state of Florida, you've got a big constituency against it. I think one of the nicest examples right here in our home area, in the early 1970s, they were going to build a big refinery off the coast of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Mm. The local people banded against it, and now Portsmouth is a really cute kind of tourist town with nice beaches that would have never been possible had that refinery been built. Alaska is just this very different case where you have a small population, many of which will profit greatly, you know, in the form of they actually have negative taxes.
Right, an annual check.
Them a check. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anytime the state produces oil. So that's a very kind of different case, I think.
Mike Dalton, you're the voice of that wilderness tonight, and I've stood there and I've never felt smaller or more in awe, I have to say, than on the tundra, just right at the edge of ANWR, and not in Prudhoe Bay, but in a very small little camp, just five men there. As many years ago, it's hard to imagine Prudhoe Bay-style development pouring over that border. Just give us a picture of what's up there tonight. What's coming in the months ahead on the natural side?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that this is an absolutely pristine and fully functioning natural ecosystem, and that it's gorgeous, and that you have, you know, it's going to be a real travesty if they bring the oil rigs up there, because what we really have is a place that we have a moral responsibility to protect, that this is a place that, you know, we have only so many of these areas around the country, so many national wildlife refuges, so many really truly pristine wilderness areas left, and we really believe that it should be off limits to oil drilling.
The polar bears come in off the ice, so this time of year they'd be moving back and forth from ice to land?
That's true, and I'd also point out, actually, this is an extremely important area for polar bears. 40% of all the polar bears that den in the United States are using the coastal plain. And a lot of the things that they do with oil exploration, like seismic drilling, they use big thumpers. It's a major problem for the mother polar bears and their dens. They can abandon those dens and leave the cubs there. So the oil exploration can have a real impact on polar bears, and it's a major concern for us.
There are the muskox, and there are the grizzlies, and there are the geese, and there's the whole crew. And today, something happened in Washington that they may very well be hearing about in not so very long from now. Mike Dalton with the Audubon Society, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And Robert Kaufman from the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a call to protect journalists from having to reveal confidential sources. This is On Point. A movement is stirring in Congress for legislation to protect journalists from having to reveal their confidential sources. A dozen House members and four senators have now signed on as sponsors to a bill that would prohibit federal agencies from forcing reporters to disclose the identity of a confidential source. The movement comes as two high-profile reporters, Judith Miller of the New York Times and Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, face jail time for refusing to name the source who leaked the identity of former CIA officer Valerie Plame. Both Miller and Cooper were at the National Press Club yesterday discussing the issue of source confidentiality. Here's an excerpt of Judith Miller's address.
What I consider Matt's in my current situation, I think back to a few days before September 11th, when I was publishing, along with two colleagues from the New York Times, a book called Germs. And that book discussed America's defensive efforts in biological warfare and its campaign to stop biological weapons from falling into the hands of terrorists. And today, that book sits on my shelf as a constant reminder of how much I depended and my colleagues depended on government sources, people who decided to share information with us, understanding that we would protect their identity. And today, I've concluded that that book probably could not be written, because since 9/11, if I were starting out to write it today, since 9/11, the culture of secrecy involving national security has really expanded dramatically. And things that used to be publicly available on websites and from government agencies are no longer available. And I think what Matt and I are caught up in is a small part of this effort to clamp down on information that I believe the public has a right to know. This national secrecy culture flies in the face of real national security, I believe. One of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission was that there be more information available about many aspects of national security to the public, such as what is the CIA's budget? How much are we spending on intelligence in this country? Well, the Federation of American Scientists, which tracks secrecy through its secrecy project, is now in a prolonged legal battle with the CIA over the publication of the CIA's budget from the 1960s. So I think when I look around me and I see how much harder it is in a post 9/11 environment to get information and get that information to the public, I realize how much more dependent we are today on the courage of government officials or people in large corporations who also affect our lives coming forth for whatever reason to discuss grievances or a minority view or things they feel are bad that are taking place within the government or within their company. And I think that's why, even though I know I don't want to go to jail and I know Matt doesn't as the father of a young child, I think that there is a principle that's so important here at stake that we have to be willing to do that.
New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who is facing jail time for contempt of court for not revealing the name of a confidential source. She spoke yesterday at the National Press Club in Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Rachel Dornhill, Mylene Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skoog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.